Very good. Okay. Oops. Whoops. Fantastic. Do you want to actually do the scrolling for me? Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, I'll just take this off. Oops.
It's much easier with this.
Very good. Okay, that's much better. This is.
And I think this is.
Okay. So scroll it? No? There's a scroll. Can't scroll it. So please make yourselves comfortable while we get the scroller ready. We have one piece of the paper here anyway, so we can just use the forget about the computer. Let's just use ancient technology. Oops. Sorry? Can you scroll it? You reckon? Sorry? Okay, very good. So just welcome everybody for a little sutta class, and this is teaching from the word of the Buddha, and what we have been doing is that there was a volume which was an anthology of some of the suttas, and this was compiled by Venerable Jnanatiloka over 100 years ago. And it's a very good idea to get the basic teachings of the Buddha in a form around the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, just core teachings. And it became very popular, but it is good that it gets revised every now and again. So I have made a new translation of some of these terms, with also making sure that many of the repetitions are sort of taken out. And some of the similes which you had before, we make a little bit more meaningful for you. So, for example, you won't see this one here, but the old simile of somebody who was shot with an arrow, and who wonders, before they go and see a doctor, just know who shot the arrow, what was the arrow made out of. And these days you'll find that people don't get shot by arrows, they got shot by guns. So you change it just slightly, keeping the essence of the simile to make it more meaningful. And you'll find that as we go through this little word of the Buddha. Now, of course, so just having one little class here in this particular trip, you won't have time to do much. So we're going to do on the right mindfulness subject, which you have there in your little sheets, and also on the projector over here. And of course you will find that there are some translations which you haven't had before, which is important, because if you wanted just to hear what you already know, it would not be of great importance to you. Whenever you come to a talk or a lecture, it should be being able to see it from a different angle than you've seen before. And of course, you all know that as well as being a teacher, I also do have a brain. you know, trained at Cambridge, and I also know the suttas extremely well, and teaching Pali. So because I do have some authority, and I can actually, any changes here which you think are, you've never heard before, I can back them up very easily. So, usually, whenever we teach suttas, it was my training, we begin by just doing the Namo Tassa three times. Out of respect, these are the teachings of the Buddha. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Very good. So now please sit comfortably, and after every little section I will pause, so if people wish to ask questions to discuss the points as they come up, you're most welcome to do so. So right mindfulness, this is the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, the four focuses of mindfulness. And now you see that instead of calling it four foundations of mindfulness, I call it the four focuses of mindfulness, because this is where you shine the light of mindfulness on these four areas of the body. Vedana I call experience, not the pleasure, pain or in between. Those are the three types of experience, as I will come to later on. The mind, the citta, and also mind objects. So there's slight differences there, but the reason why we focus on these areas here is because that's where mindfulness can uncover the Dhamma and lead to enlightenment. That's why I call it the four focuses of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana. And what are these four? And straight away you can see that there is a translation there which is far more accurate. This is based on Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, and it's also it's in accord with what is said in the commentaries to this, and accord with what's said in the rest of the suttas, where it said, lead in one direction only. And it is very mischievous. It's not supported by the Pali, by the commentaries, or the rest of the teachings of the Buddha, to call this the only way. That is very mischievous, because it has no support in reason. There is another place, it's verse, I think, 2-3, I think, of the Dhammapada, where it says, Ezo wa margo nati anyo dasa nasa visuddhiya, which you all know means, it's Pali, this the only path, there is no other, for the purification of insight. And that refers to the Eightfold Path. So where we have the only way, that always means the Eightfold Path, not just onefold. And that is so consistent with the whole of the teachings of the Buddha. So consistency is important. So actually I think I got the quote wrong. It's not 272 or something, but it's in the Magga section, the past section of the Dhammapada. Ezo wa margo nati anyo dasa nasa visuddhiya. This is the only path, there is no other, for the purification of insight. So it does mean, goes in one direction only, to the purification of beings, going beyond sadness and crying, disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana. Now what are the four? Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. And the same with having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of experience, vedana, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the mind, the citta, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of mind objects, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing and mindful. Now you see with each of these four, and it's nice actually putting a 1, 2, 3, 4, because this is a modern world, so you put 1, 2, 3, 4, list them, and it makes it easier for you to comprehend. But you see the translation there, which you may not be accustomed to, is having restrained the five hindrances. Because the Pali is loke abhijja dhammanasa, so vinaya, loke abhijja dhammanasaṃ. And there you will find in the commentaries, there's two Satipatthana suttas. There's the Satipatthana Sutta, number 10 of the Majjhima Nikaya, and the Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. They have commentaries, and those commentaries both say that the word loke abhijja dhammanasaṃ, which many people recognize, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world, because that was a translation done by Professor Rice Davies over 100 years ago. It stuck. And to me, when I first read that, what does that mean? Having restrained grief for the world? Maybe you have grief for your grandmother who's passed away, but grief for the world? And covetousness, we don't usually say that word anymore. But you take one look at the commentaries, and straight away it said that means the first two hindrances. And by extension, in Pali, if you mention the first two of a group, all the others in that group are to be mentors included. So, what it means is those first two hindrances have been abandoned, and with it the other three, or the five hindrances. Now, when I first learned my Pali, this was under A.K. Warder, he made a very important point that the best way to learn Pali is to read, so you can actually see how these words are used in context. And when you read through the suttas in the Pali, you saw that many times loke abhijja, what was translated as covetousness for the world, was used as a synonym, as a replacement for kamachanda, the first part of the five hindrances. It was the same, not just once or twice, many times. The first hindrance in the group of five hindrances was called loke abhijja. So it means it's a synonym, an alternative word for the same thing. So loke abhijja is not just the commentaries, but the suttas support that means the first hindrance. And the second, dhammanasa, is used in two places, in the Majjhima and also in the Sutta Nipata, as an alternative for the second hindrance. So it does actually mean loke abhijja dhammanasa, grief and covetousness for the world, do refer to the first two of the five hindrances. And it's also true, just the way that Pali works, if you mean the first two, the others of a standard group are also included. So it does have a lot of sense, meaning having restrained the five hindrances. Not abandoned the five hindrances, for vinaya is the same root as vinaya. It's a training, a restraining, to weakening these five hindrances to the point where you can be mindful. And as you all know, that mindfulness, if you have lots of craving or desire, lots of anger, you're not really aware of what's coming on in here. You're aware of what you want out there. If you're angry, you've got ill will, you're not really aware of what it's doing to your body and mind. You're planning what you want to do to your enemy. And both of those means your mindfulness is not where it's supposed to be, and it also gets very weak. That's what tires you out, or gets you very restless, swinging all over the place. So those four hindrances, the second two, always come from the first two. So this is actually pretty accurate. You need to restrain the five hindrances and doubt as well, which is another form of restlessness. You have to restrain those five hindrances first to a point where you can be mindful, even just of the body. Now you know that soon we come to mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of the breathing. How hard is it to be aware of your breath? It's because the five hindrances haven't been calmed down yet. How do you calm down those five hindrances? Basic calming down comes from the first factors of the Eightfold Path, from a right view, such as, you know, right view of non-self. So this is something which Ajahn Chah would always teach me again and again and again. You meditate not to attain things, but to get rid of things, to let go. Now that, by the very start of it, means you are calming your mind down. This mind always wants stuff. So from the right view, then we have the right intentions, what I usually call the right motivations, where you're coming from. From right view, that is what you're doing this for. We're doing this not to attain or get rid of things. The right motivation, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, is to renounce, to be kind, to be gentle. Nekama Sankhapa, Avayapada Sankhapa, and Ahimsaka Sankhapa. The three parts of the second factor of the Eightfold Path. This is where we're coming from. And once we're doing this, not to get things or get rid of things, but to let go of things, to be kind, be gentle, and that motivates the next three factors of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood. We're doing this not to get things, but to let go of things, to be kind, to be gentle. And from those three parts of the speech, action, and livelihood, then that brings us on to just the sixth factor of the right energy. The right mode, the right, you won't call it effort even, because to let go, it's like a right stopping. We don't call it effort. I call it right endeavor. In other words, it means you're not trying to do things, you're trying to stop things, to let go, to be kind, to be gentle. That by itself serves the purpose of weakening the five hindrances. So the first six factors of the Eightfold Path weaken the five hindrances so that we can do Satipatthana. This is what it means by, we're talking about letting go of things and things disappearing. The whole text has now disappeared. But you've got it on your things over here somewhere. So anyway, that is the reason why that this is a sequential process, in the sense that once you're mindful, once you have restrained the five hindrances, then you can be aware of these things. Abide, aware of this body, energized, and the experience, the mind and the mind objects, knowing the purpose of what you are doing. Why are we doing this? And we see it is to realize later on, it's just a body, that's all, just experience, just a mind, just mind objects, nothing more than that, not me, not mine, not a self. And mindful. So that's the beginning. It's already, hopefully, things which you haven't heard before. So, any questions or comments? It's all right to disagree with a monk. Because if you have a disagreement and you put up, it usually comes to a very worthwhile conversation. No? Okay. So we go to the first of the Satipatthanas, which is the mindfulness of the body. And it does begin with mindfulness of breathing. So mindfulness of breathing, you go to a quiet, secluded place, sit down comfortably, and give priority to establishing mindfulness. Then mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. Now this is a pretty accurate translation, may not be what you are used to, but to go to a secluded place. Now, many people say, well, you can meditate on the bus going to work, you can meditate in the marketplace. If you're a skilled meditator, yes, you can do that. But when you first begin, it's much better to have conducive environments, places of peace. And indeed, just going off the subject over here, there are some places in this world where you can sit and meditate, and it's quite easy to meditate. Other places are difficult. You may have found places like that. If you go to any of those places in India where the Buddha lived, and some of those have got such amazing energy. It's so easy to meditate and get very peaceful and very still. And even those people who have visited my monastery in the meditation retreat center in Jhana Grove, you find our meditation hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, that's built up a lot of really good energy. Even to the point when I was away somewhere, somebody brought their Feng Shui master over, and he's a very famous Feng Shui master. He went into that hall and straight away, wow, this has got amazing Feng Shui, especially in the front of the hall. The back, not so much. But the back, close to where the Buddha statue is, it's got really strong energy. And if ever you have the opportunity to visit there, go and meditate in there. You'll find your meditation is much easier there than other places. That's just the nature of things. So you go to a secluded place, which got some good energy. You sit down comfortably. Now, in the text, it does say to sit down cross-legged with your back straight. But if you try that, people have so much aches and pains that they stop meditating and they probably go to the doctor afterwards. In the old days, people would sit on the floor with their back straight, but anyone who has any idea of anatomy or physiotherapy, you know the most comfortable position for your back, 15 degrees from the vertical, leaning back, exactly how your chairs are. Science says that's the most comfortable. And just sitting on a chair means you don't have too much aches and pains. If I asked you all to sit on the floor when you were meditating, maybe only a dozen of you will be in here, the rest will be back home. Because this is not torture. This is actually comfortably, so you can maintain comfort for long enough to get peaceful. Even when you get very old, and you cannot sit on the floor, to be able to sit in a comfortable chair is fine. And as you probably have all seen, there are many, not that one there, but many carvings, ancient carvings of the Buddha sitting on a chair. So please don't think you're better than the Lord Buddha. You can sit on a chair as well, if you know you need to. So this is comfortable. And give priority to establishing mindfulness. Straight away, people used to say, oh, to put mindfulness in front of you. In front of who? In front of you. What do you mean, in front of me? There's no me in here anyway, so where should I put it? And, of course, in the Western world, we think we're in our heads, so in front of me is up here somewhere. And that's where we get the nose meditation from. It never says that. Of course, you know, you ask your maybe your great-grandparents, and they always thought they were up in here somewhere. So mindfulness in front of you should be, you know, in front of your chest somewhere. But it never means that. It means giving it priority, putting it number one on your list, putting it first. The same English word, priority, means the first in the line, in front of everything else. Because what we need to do, as you probably found in your own experience, if you don't establish enough mindfulness first of all, it's a waste of time watching the breath. You'll wander off, you'll fall asleep, and you start thinking about all sorts of different things. So what the mindfulness of breathing, secluded place, sit down comfortably and give priority to establishing mindfulness, number one. Once you have enough mindfulness, then you can breathe in, then you can breathe out. Biggest mistake when people do breath meditation is going to the breath too soon. Then they can't do it. They give up. It's not that the Buddha gave bad advice. It's people not reading the instructions. Just like how many times have you got a new washing machine or a microwave or something and you plug it in first and it goes bang and only then do you read the instructions. So that is not the right way to do things. So once you've got my... And know what... ways of establishing mindfulness, giving it priority. Present moment awareness, letting go of the past and the future, a bit of silence, and then you can actually be pretty mindful. Just relax, let go. Another way of giving priority to mindfulness is whenever you come on to half an hour's meditation. Before you come in, quarter of an hour before, just don't sort of rush around. Just relax before you come in, just to get into the mood of things. And then that's preparation, so that when you are meditating, you can get into the meditation pretty quickly. Because meditation does not start when you sit on the chair or on the cushion. It started quarter of an hour, half an hour beforehand, what you've been doing. So, the mightier you breathe in, the mightier you breathe out. That's a preparation. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. You don't make them long or make them short. Sometimes if you are short of breath and you try and make it long, that stretches you out. If you like to breathe in long, you have to breathe in short. That again stresses you out. These are alternatives, not stage one, stage two. You'd have to do this one first, and then you do that one. Sometimes my breath is not long or short. It's sort of in between somewhere. The point is, you just know what your breath is doing. So it just gives you a little bit of anchor to know what the breath is up to. And sometimes, instead of actually knowing whether they're long or short, some people count the breath. Some people give this mantras with the breath, the Buddho, Buddho. Or, like I tried in Australia, breathing in, you say to yourself, shut. Breathing out, you say, up, shut, up, shut. Or, if anyone who knows Bahasa, mati pasti, mati pasti. I will die, that's for sure. It just makes it interesting, just to get your awareness there, so you're not bored. So anyway, just it's long, it's short. Then you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. Now, the whole of the breath, the Pali is sabakaya patisangvedi, the whole kaya. It sometimes means a physical body, but really it means a whole group of things. Just like in English, any lawyers here, you have a body of evidence. Any military here, a body of troops. And the word kaya is used in so many ways to mean a group of things together. And sabakaya means a whole lot. And even later, in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha specifically says, I call the breath a body, a kaya, one of the bodies. That's what he particularly says. And so this is not just feeling the body as you're breathing, but just feeling the whole body of the breath. From the very beginning of an in-breath, just watch my finger, just right to the end of the in-breath. And the out-breath, right to the end, not missing a moment. So that's what this really means, really being aware. And you can see just this happens quite naturally as you start to settle down. You don't just see breathing in, breathing out. You see just the whole of the breath. And any of you who do Chankama, the walking meditation, that this is what happens when you're walking. Left, right, but then you see the very beginning of the foot moving and how it moves through the air and how it falls to the ground again. This is the complete awareness. That's the when you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. And then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. And then here again, it's a kaya sankara. This is a body caused phenomena, your breathing, as you breathe in and out. Now, the simile which you may have heard before, just as a lathe operator knows when he does a long turn or a short turn. How many of you have operated a lathe without electricity? And I did. We had one of those. We built one of those in our monastery in Thailand. So I understand what that really means, but no one else does. So let's use the same idea, but in a different simile. Just as a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when the in-breath is long, you're aware that it is long. Now see that what I'm doing here, keeping the essence of the simile, but making it something which people can understand. So, and I stick to that because it makes these teachings of the Buddha more powerful and more relevant for people. But still, I stick to my guns here that this, you know, is legitimate. In this way, you're aware of your own body, or you're aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours. They say aware of others' bodies. So it doesn't mean that when you're aware of somebody, you're just aware of all the beautiful girls or the beautiful guys. So that's, I'm doing mindfulness of the body, of breathing. I'm just watching other people's bodies. It means that just as your body, just as my body, whether you, whatever you are, old or young, the nature of all is the same. Or you abide aware of the nature of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body. You know, the rise and the fall. But you see, it's from the Satipatthana Samyutta. This is the other group of whole lot of sayings about the Satipatthana. That what does it mean by the rise and the fall? It means what causes the rise and the fall. What causes the appearance of the body and its maintenance is the four aharas, the four nutriments. The four nutriments. And the four nutriments are coarse food, like your rice and curries, your potatoes, your sandwiches. Also, it is the contact, you know, the sensory experience. Without sensory experience, that's a fascinating. Any of you who have ever been a doctor or a nurse, anyone in a coma, and if you maybe they can't hear you or can't see you, but maybe they can. Keep talking to them, keep touching them, because when that sensory contact is maintained, there's a good chance you will keep them going, and they'll come out of the coma. But if you don't give them sensory input, without sensory input, again, the body cannot be maintained. And the other part of the third of these nutriments for the maintenance of the body is will. And you all know that the will to live, or people just give up. And that is such an important determinator of whether the body survives or whether it just disappears and goes. It's a food as much as rice and curry is a food. And the last one is consciousness. Those four things are the four aharas. That causes the body to arise and keeps it going. When those are taken away, the body vanishes. It just dies. So that's the, and so you are aware what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments. You are aware that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. Or you just abide contemplating the body's cause and nature, both arising and ceasing. Or else mindfulness is just a body, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. Instead of saying a soul or a self, I prefer like the permanent essence. And you know, this is atta, this essence. It is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. That's the reason for this, so we can be liberated. We can understand what it is. And then you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is one way that you are mindful of the body. So, do you want to interrupt me? Any questions, comments, complaints? Yes, thank you. It also gives me a chance to have a sip of carrot juice.
Ajahn, when you say mindful of the breath, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you try to be mindful of the breath, but at the same time you're also, you watch your breath and your stomach moving too, and you're aware of like both. So how do you just not...
It is great if you weren't taught meditation before, because like a blank slate. Because the first time I came to Malaysia many years ago, that I was stunned because people started complaining about samadhi headache. And I'd never ever heard that when I was in Thailand or any other part of the world. What is samadhi headache? They say, oh, when we practice mindfulness of the breath, oh, we have this big stress over our brows over here. Really, lots of aches and pains and headaches. And it took me a while. What are you doing that for? Because you're focusing on your nose. To understand what's happening, I'll take off my glasses. Usually, when you're watching the tip of the nose, you have your eyelids closed. I'm going to keep my eyelids open so you can see what my eyeballs are doing when I'm watching the breath at the tip of my nose. And if I keep doing this for too long, I will have stress headache over here as well. Now, that's actually what you're doing. Because what your mind thinks it's focusing on, even subconsciously, you know, without you realizing it, your eyes are going there as well. And you're holding that with force, and of course you're going to get stressed. When a person comes to meditation, they haven't done much meditation before, or they haven't learnt anything, I just ask them a very simple exercise. Close your eyes and breathe in and out 3 times. At the end of the third breath, open your eyes. A very simple exercise. Anyone can do that. But then I ask them, once they got their eyes open, how did you know you were breathing in? How did you know you were breathing out? You knew. And they don't need to answer me, but they know what their breath was doing. And they weren't watching the tip of their nose, they weren't watching their belly, they were watching their breath. That's all it is. So you know you're breathing in. You don't have to focus anywhere. Just know the breath. And that really helps. So it's a personal anecdote. Now, because my father, you know, had asthma, I never had asthma, but I do have allergies. I have hay fever in that part of the season. So it was a case that when I was told you have to watch the breath at the tip of the nose, I thought, my goodness, just like you, you know, sneezing. It's okay to sneeze, nothing wrong with that. If I ask you to watch the tip of the nose, it'd be very difficult if you've got an itchy nose and sneezing. So, but it's wonderful that, you know, I thought, you don't have to watch the tip of the nose. You can just watch the breath somewhere. Because even if my nose was blocked, you know, with hay fever, I was still breathing. So all I needed to know is I was breathing in, I was breathing out. That's all. It's not nose meditation, it's not belly meditation, it's breath meditation. You know you're breathing in, you know you're breathing out. And that means it becomes much easier. You don't need to watch the nose, you don't need to watch the belly. Just ask yourself, am I breathing in, am I breathing out? You know, this is something which I like teaching, that to arouse mindfulness, ask a question of your body. To be mindful of, say, your legs. How's your leg now? It's okay, I don't need that. I'll just put it back up again. I know what you're up to again. This is fine. So you ask, how's your leg? And then you go on, you're just too kind. Go on, okay. So you ask, how is your leg? And just try them out. How's your leg now? Now you're aware of your leg. It directs mindfulness there when you ask a question. So you just ask, am I breathing in? You know straight away. Am I breathing out? How you know, where you know, is not important. Yes. Does this include the element of
thinking? Because it's written here, you abide aware of what causes the arising and seeking of the body, and mindfulness that it is just a body, impermanent, suffering, not me, not mine.
What it does with actually thinking, it's not thinking, it's actually something different where we get awareness and understanding. Now, this is a simile which I need your cooperation here to know the difference between thinking and contemplation. What is this I'm holding in my hand?
A cup.
What else is it? It's not just a cup. One cup. Yeah, what else? Give me some more information. What else? Keep going. but what am I holding here? Now, the reason we do this exercise is, and the reason I wanted you to participate, when you first say cup, you think that's it. I've got it, you don't go any further. That's what thinking is. It gives it a name, what you've been taught. Old knowledge doesn't take it any deeper. When I ask you, keep on looking. What else can you see? You say white, you see just big at the bottom, small at the bottom, big at the top, and a ceramic. The longer you look, the more information you get, the more you see. And it soon is no such thing as a right answer here, because you think, now this is the right answer. Yes, congratulations, you've got the right answer. This is not that at all. You keep on looking and you see deeper. And the deeper you see, the more you go beyond what you've been taught, and to see it in a totally new way. It's innovation, it is insight, new knowledge. The same, this is not thinking. Thinking just is giving it a name. You see it in a totally different way. So that is not thinking. Lingering on something, so it's on the body, just letting it be there long enough for it to teach you something you haven't seen before. It's the thoughts, the names, or the old knowledge that stops insight happening. Don't give it a name. Let it come and teach you something new. To do that, you have to be still.
Okay, thanks, Ajahn.
Very good. Okay. So we can go to the next of the Satipatthanas, the four postures. When walking, you're aware in the present, I'm walking, standing, sitting, lying down, you're aware in the present, I'm lying down. Thus you maintain present moment awareness of however your body is disposed. Now you see I've added this idea of mindfulness always being in the present moment. Because if you're thinking about how your body was this morning, or how it's going to be later on, that is not real. That's memories, that is fantasies. So to be real, mindfulness of the postures as it's happening, live. Not recordings, not reruns, now. So you're aware of how your body is right now. In this way, you're aware of your own body, you're aware the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, you're by the way both your own and others' bodies. However, you're aware, by being aware of this body, every moment in the postures, you understand just what this body is and how it works. In particular, that what causes the arising of the body, when those four nutriments cease, the body goes, you're by contemplating this body's causal nature, both arising and ceasing. Or mindfulness, just the body, that's all. Impermanent, suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation. You abide, not clinging to anything in the world. That's another way you're mindful of the body. Or full comprehension of the purpose of why the body is doing these things. You act in full comprehension of the purpose, that's sampajanya. Sampajanya literally means the with wisdom. Pajanya is a longer form of panya. It means literally with wisdom. And that's why that, you know, from the Abhidharma they always use Satipanya. And that's how, remember, Ajahn Chah always used to call it Satipanya, mindfulness with wisdom. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when looking ahead, looking away, flexing, extending your limbs, wearing your clothes and carrying things. In the sutta it says when wearing your robes and carrying your bowl. But I've never seen any of you carrying a bowl or wearing robes. So, no, just what it really means is when you're carrying things, wearing something, it just shows you just, no, this applies to all people, not just monks. You act in full comprehension of the purpose of regarding eating, drinking, defecating, urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. And even, to make it very clear, even defecating. when you go to the toilet, if you use effort and strive and push, what happens? You get sick, hemorrhoids. But if you just sit there and patient, let go, relax, then things come out without any bad side effects. That is, I mentioned that because that's so important to the Dhamma. Whenever you push things and strive for things, you always get stuffed up and just things go wrong, even with meditation. Don't push, just relax. And then everything comes out in its right course, the right time, with no bad side effects. That's why when people meditate, they're just like they're sitting on the toilet, they've got mental hemorrhoids. Please excuse me for being coarse, but you remember this now. So, okay, for a purpose. So what are you doing these things for? Walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. Now, sleeping. Because when I alert my party, they always said when falling asleep. That's the translation I heard. But it never meant that. It's a totally different word in Pali for falling asleep. It does mean sleeping, sute, in sleep. And so what do you mean? How can you be fully aware when you're asleep? And for that, for a long time, we thought, well, if you're really practicing, you know, you have to have like lucid dreaming, or like, you know, being half awake, and you can't really let your mindfulness totally go when you're asleep. And that is just total wrong. It's, why are you sleeping? What's the purpose of it? You sleep there to keep your body healthy. It's a natural process of the body, so that when you wake up afterwards, you know, you can actually just be healthy and perform whatever duties you need to do in your life. So it's understanding the purpose of these things. In this way, are you aware of talking and keeping silent? What's the purpose of these things? I know that sometimes you go on retreats, they call it noble silence. You're not allowed to speak. And I sometimes call it stupid silence. It's not noble at all. You see a snake, and you're not allowed to say it's a snake. And noble silence, going, oh. Some people are very good at miming. But other people are hopeless, and by the time they understand what you're talking about, they've bitten you. That is not noble at all. So the noble silence is, there's something to say, you say it. But you don't just get into conversations. When it's not necessary, you keep quiet. So that's the noble silence. So you understand the purpose of being awake, talking, and keeping silent. In this way, you're aware of your own body, other people's bodies, same nature as yours, you abide aware of both. You abide aware of what causes the arising of this body, you know, what ceases it, and the abide contemplating the body's cause from both arising and ceasing. I'm just going through this reasonably fast so we can get further into the Satipatthana. Or else mindfulness is just a body, that's all. We understand the purpose of doing these things. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. That is another way you are mindful of the body. Yes? Four aspects of Sampajana. It is the four aspects that is coming from the commentary, and if I remember them correctly, it's understanding the purpose, first of all, and understanding that what you're doing, is that going to fulfill the purpose or not? And I forget what the other ones are now. The gotra, whether it's the right area of what you're supposed to be doing anyway. So you're not getting into sort of trouble and danger because you're going into the wrong places. So sometimes, even as a monk, you have to be very careful of that. That there was a ceremony once, and it was held in a Burswood ballroom. Burswood is a big hotel complex which has got the only casino in Perth. And I'd never been in there before. I went with our president at the time, Sol. It was raining, and I didn't have a plan, so I was looking, where's this ballroom for this ceremony? And, you know, West Australian of the Year ceremony. And we didn't know where it was. We were walking, getting lost, and we found out there's this doorway and all these incredibly bright lights. It was the entrance to the casino. Now let's get out of here quick, because if somebody had taken a photograph, that I shouldn't have been there. There's no way that I could have escaped criticism for that. Even it was totally. So that's like sometimes you have to know the gotcha, that where you're really supposed to be, where you're not supposed to be. You get very dangerous. So it's basically knowing, you know, what the purpose of all this is. The bodily parts. You review your body from head to toe, bounded by skin. It's made up of many kinds of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs. You don't go through the whole. How many are there parts of the body? 31 in the Satipatthana Sutta. In the commentaries, 32. 32 in the commentaries, 31 in the suttas. You know the one they left out? The brain. Interesting, isn't it? The suttas were a no-brainer. Because the brain wasn't that important in the time of the Buddha. Interesting, but now the brain is just so important. And that's why we've got so many problems, I reckon. Too much in the brain, not enough in the heart. But anyway, and you say 31 parts, you can add a few extra over there because anatomy has become much more refined. So anyway, it doesn't matter. However you want to split it up in all sorts of different parts. And instead of a bag with hill rice and red rice and something else rice, again, modernize the simile but keep its essence, just as though there were a full shopping bag with many kinds of groceries, such as bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables. This was known for Australia. Over here you might say chili paste, rice, dumplings, whatever. But no, so just so you can change it, but it means there's different parts, a bag with different parts. So too, you review this same body full of many parts. In this body there are hair, bones, shit and urine. This is another way you're mindful of the body. Or elements. You review your body by way of elements. Thus, in this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element and the air element. You just split it up into parts so you know it's just nothing more than that. You review, so this is another way you're mindful of the body. Or the nine charnel ground contemplations. People really sometimes are a bit weird, but they love really getting into this. You see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground up to 3 days old, bloated, livid and losing matter. Then you reflect that your own body is the same nature. It might become like that. It's not exempt from that fate. You see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground being devoured by birds, animals or maggots. You reflect your own body is of the same nature. It may be like that and not exempt from that fate. You see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews, disconnected bones scattered in all directions, bones bleached white, the colour of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbling to dust. Then you reflect your own body is the same nature, it may become like that, it is not exempt from that fate. So, that usually, sort of, how many of you have seen corpses like that? I used to say that, you know, it's very rare you see in these days, you know, corpses with thrown aside in the charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews. But people tell me that now they've got all these TV shows, CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, where they have old bodies, all sorts of stuff. So you can actually see them on the TV these days. It's very rare to actually see even a dead body at all, let alone one in a state of decay, because we hide that, you know, in our sort of modern world. But all it means is just our body is the nature of decay, just like anything else. So in this way, you are aware of your own body, you are aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, or you're aware of both your own and others' bodies. or else you are abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments, you abide aware the body is the same nature to cease when the four nutriments cease. So you abide contemplating the body's cause and nature, both arising and ceasing. Or else mindful is just a body, impermanent, suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. It's established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, satipanya, essential for liberation. You are independent, not clinging to bodies, either your own or other people's, in this world. Another way, you are mindful of the body. You're mindful of the body in order to let it go. Not me, not mine, not a self. Impermanent, comes and goes. This is nature. Suffering. So, benefits of mindfulness. Any questions on that so far? You understand why we're doing this? So not attached to our body or other people's body. And you'll understand that when somebody dies. If you get a phone call, or SMS these days, that maybe someone close to you has died, do you get shocked? Or do you say, I expected that? If you understand the Dhamma, you say, I expected that. We can die at any time. All of us, any one of us. Doesn't matter how old or how young. That comes from the nature of the body. We really understand it. So, the benefits of mindfulness of the body. Where mindfulness of the body has been repeatedly practiced and developed, these 10 benefits may be expected. You overcome delight and discontent, especially with bodies. And so you don't have to worry what other people think of your body. You don't, I don't dye my hair. I don't have any implants. I don't wear makeup. Body's just the body. So it's wonderful just when you just accept when this body gets old, there's nothing wrong with being old. Just enjoy your old age and your decay. Also, even dementia. I did a conference on dementia in Singapore with this expert, and he said the signs of dementia are, number one, you let go of the past, you can't remember the past. Number two, you don't worry about the future, you can't even think of the future. And number three, you become socially disengaged, like a hermit. And I think, my goodness, I've been teaching people to do that most of my life. Yes, go on. Yeah, go on.
Decaying, accepting decaying of the body, the aging, things like that. But when you get to that stage, right, I've noticed a lot of old people that they can't accept it. So how do you, as a practicing Buddhist, how would we practice to accept that this body is decaying, my mind is going, I can't do things for myself? It's very hard, isn't it?
No, it means you get this wonderful opportunity for your dear husband to make some good karma. Because he can look after you now. Or your children. Don't you remember the Buddha saying that the one who looks after the sick is like looking after the Buddha? That's a huge karma. Say, darling, if your husband's a Buddhist, you say, look, darling, this is what the Buddha says, looking after the sick is like looking after the Buddha. You've got this amazing opportunity to make incredible karma, because I'm sick, so look after me. In other words, don't be embarrassed. Because some people look at sickness as by being a personal failure. And I'm a burden on other people. But you're not a burden on other people when you're sick. You're an opportunity. Other people, you'll find out how people care about you. And just the amazing things which people will do to look after you. So sometimes being sick is a wonderful opportunity to offer your body for others to look after and to pamper. don't be so independent and proud, because it is very embarrassing, and it just it really takes down your ego a lot when you have to have somebody else wipe your bottom for you, because you can't do it yourself. And all those things you used to do for yourself, you just can't do anymore. It just is a great teaching for yourself, lessening your pride, and a great teaching for other people to look after you. So I look at it totally different. Nothing wrong with being sick. You know, all of your family, children, you looked after them for such a long time. Now it's your turn, children, to look after me. I'm sick, I'm dying. Please look after me. It's a great lesson for them as well. This is our nature of our body. It gets sick, it dies. So please, come and view me dying. You don't fall sick and you die. Well, that's really being quite selfish for others. Not giving the opportunity. I don't know. That's just, if that happens, it's wonderful for you. You have a really nice time. Okay, that's only the first discontent.
Hey, Ajahn.
Oh, yeah.
How do you endure the pain, the mental pain, physical pain, when someone's sick and it's a long aging process?
Well, you mean when you are sick or when somebody
else? You are sick or someone else is sick.
Ah, when somebody else is sick, you only get painful when you feel I can't help them. And a poor person is sort of getting very sick. So it's a teaching for you. So number one, other people's pain, sort of it teaches you that you're subject to the same. So it's a lesson for you. But as it's for you, there are two types of pain, the mental pain and the physical pain. And the Buddha called the two darts or arrows. Physical pain you can't do much about, it's just part of the body. But the majority of that pain is the mental, the way we react to it. And even, I think, doctors, neuroscientists, said there are actually two pathways. You know, from like a pain, if I sort of burn my finger, there's actually two different pathways into the brain, two different circuits. One is the physical, one is the mental. They can actually see that. And it's the physical one, it's not that bad. The mental one, that's a really bad one. When I say, this is going to hurt, whoa, this is going to, you're going to wish you'd never been born, this is really going to be terrible. And they make you really experience, this is going to be terrible pain, and then it really is painful. So please, if any of you in those professions, a doctor or nurse, never tell the patient, this is going to hurt. just say, oh, it's okay. And then just, when they don't feel it's going to hurt, then it hurts much less. The mental part is the biggest part. And that's something which we can do by our meditation practice. Just to, again, much of that mental is actually going off into the future. I can't stand this any longer, going into the future. This moment you're standing it. It's okay. You know, you're bearing with it. But when you feel, how long is this going to last? That is the problem. It's the mental projections, the fear, makes the pain the most hard to endure.
Practice the meditation part, as you say, the mental side. But then how do you help somebody who are not a meditator, who is suffering, I mean, aging, and they are suffering but not accepting it?
Well, you can do what Ajahn Chah taught me. Because when I was sick in hospital, he came up to me. You know what's coming, don't you? So tell your mother, your grandpa or whatever, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. It's not going to last. You know, that's true. So, that's not very kind. It is kind to teach them some Dhamma. So anyway, unfortunately they do have like medications, painkillers and stuff. And it's totally off subject. If any of, you know, your parents, grandparents or yourself is in extreme pain and they administer morphine, no problem at all, please take it. Like taking a Panadol or an aspirin or something. Because I've seen this so many times, that Buddhists think that the last moments before you die are the most important. They don't want to take those painkillers because they just destroy your mindfulness. So they think. But it's so common that you may be under morphine in your last dying moments, and just before you get to that point of death, you become clear, you wake up. See that so many times. That an example of that is of a one person who's one of my disciples with her sister. Her father was in a coma, dying, and they were just holding his hand either side of the bed. He was in a coma for an hour, maybe a day and a half or something, just waiting for that last breath. And then, without any warning at all, the father opened his eyes, and he leant up, looked back at his two daughters, and they immediately said, "We love you, Dad." And then he fell back and died. His last moments were clear. And that's happened so often. But this actually shows it's a phenomena which many people have seen. That yes, you may be in a coma, you may be, doped to your eyeballs in morphine, painkillers, but the last moment you're free. So you don't have to worry that your last moment will be clear, even if you've been in coma, even if you're under anesthetic, if you're under morphine, your last moment is clear anyway. So you don't have to worry about, I better not take the painkiller because I won't be aware. You will. Okay. So you overcome delight and discontent. Most of that compares to your body. Overcome fear and dread. Ooh, I'm going to die. Ooh. Because most of the fear is losing something you're attached to, and in particular your body. You bear cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contacts with flies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind, the sun, and creeping things. You endure also unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful and menacing to life. Just my body, that's all. Because a lot of times we're so afraid of what this is going to do. It's going to kill me. I'm going to die. Nothing wrong with dying. We all have to do it sooner or later. Yeah, so let's get it over and done with. Now, the next part is interesting. You experience whenever needed, without difficulties, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and prove a pleasant abiding in this very life. Now, that seems to be, for some of you, maybe a disconnect. We'll suddenly go from just overcome delight, discontent, overcome fear and dread and cold and heat to the jhanas. The reason people have problems entering a jhana is because they're attached to their bodies. With the body, the five senses. That's the biggest hindrance to entering the jhanas. So much in our bodies. That being able to let them go completely and go into the mind, the mental world, where the body is just transcended, that's difficult for people. But the more we do this body awareness, and the more we understand the nature of this body, doesn't belong to us, and we're not so concerned with it, it makes it much easier to let the body go, to renounce, and just go into a deep meditation. So this is how you can let go of the body, because you'll be mindful of it, you know what it is, and then you can go into jhanas easily. And after the jhanas, then you can get the cool stuff. You wield the various kinds of supernormal powers. Kids love this stuff. Having supernormal powers or special abilities. They've got movies about this, about people with special abilities. Spider-Man. What else have you got? Iron Man. Copper Man. But they still haven't got Super Monk yet. And there's a reason why, because once you get these sort of powers, you're no violence in at all. No violence, no romance. So the movie will never sell.
Super, I have these powers, but no one's interested. So he experienced whenever you wield the various kinds of super. Having been one, you become many. Having been many, you become one. You appear and vanish. You go unhindered through a wall or through a mountain, as so through space. You dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird. You wield bodily mastery even as the paths of Brahma world. Or with a divine ear, you hear sounds both heavenly and human, those that are far and what is near. You can read the minds of another person, having compassed them with your own mind, especially whether the mind is affected by one of the five hindrances or whether it's experienced a jhana. You recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births, and many eons of expanding universes, many eons of decaying universes. There I was, so named, with such a family, with such an appearance. Such was my food. Such was my experience of pleasure and pain. Such was my lifetime, and passing away from there, I reappeared in this other place. And there too I was so named, with such a family, such my lifetime, passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus, with the aspects and particulars, you recollect many of your past lives. And with clairvoyance, the divine eye, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. One understands how beings are reborn according to their karma. And lastly, the most important, by realizing for yourself with direct experience in this very life, you enter upon the abiding and the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom. You are an enlightened one. So that's the best. Do these other ones exist? Yes, they do. But there is dangers in these. Because, remember, for those of you who studied your Buddhism, the story of Devadatta? He developed psychic powers. But because he developed the psychic powers, that he still thought that they were his and his attainment. And so he became very proud and conceited. Thought he was as good as, if not better, than the Buddha. And in my first year, when I first went to Wat Bapong in northeast Thailand, 43 years ago, there was a Thai monk there who had developed the clairaudience, the divine ear. You know, he claimed he could listen to conversations happening a long way away. Now when a monk, a good monk, makes those claims, it's such a serious claim, they have to be investigated. Because if they're just boasting, that is just like sexual intercourse for a monk. You have to disrobe. It's one of the four parajika, the four disrobal rules. Claim you have a supernormal power when you haven't. So they investigated it and they found out it was true. This monk could actually hear conversations a long way away. But what happened next was very informative to me. Then he went to sit in Ajahn Chah's chair, as if he was as good as Ajahn Chah. He got pride coming up. He took it as a personal accomplishment. And having a teacher like an Ajahn Chah, he took him aside and taught him. The next day, there's about maybe 40, 50, 60 monks at that time in Wat Bapong. And this is a senior monk. He bowed to each one of us to ask forgiveness. Even though he's much senior, obviously he understood from Ajahn Chah he made a big mistake. He bowed to each one of us and that day left. I've never seen him again. Don't know what happened to him. Probably went into solitude and never ever told anybody about any of his powers again. Because sometimes that's one of the reasons why, monks or nuns, lay people, please keep these things quiet. Because what it does, often it gives rise to pride and ego. So these things do exist, but a lot of times we don't keep it quiet, we don't practice it, because otherwise people would come here trying to figure out how you're cheating. How are you actually doing this? It can't be happening. There must be some string somewhere or something happening, some trick. So that's one of the reasons why we don't do any of these things in public. Any questions about that?
Well,
What's the purpose of going through a past life?
Going through a past life, I think I mentioned this, I think was it yesterday, about one of the people in Perth who went to past life regression. You know, didn't believe in past lives before, but you know, he went to past life regression because he wanted to check it out before he'd asked his brother, who did have some problems, to go through it. And he got amazing information. He didn't believe it at first, but he wrote it all down, went to the library, and it all checked out 100%. Now, for him, that proved it. He had no doubt at all from that. How anyone can get this information, which he could never really get from any other source, but he was there in the library, photographs, everything, marriage certificates, the deed of title for the land they gave him. And as a result of that, you know, being an Aussie guy, you know, like going to the pub with his friends, had to give up drinking. He had to keep the five precepts, even though it was a struggle for him, because once you realize the past life, you realize, you know, from that also some of how karma works. So, you know, he became this incredible good Buddhist, always really concerned about making good karma, being service, doing service, keeping his precepts. He had to, got no choice now, he told me, because he'd remembered his past life. It does actually make a lot of difference to you. Of course it applies to everybody. The effect it usually does, they see the bigger picture. If it's just this one life, like, you know, a child dies, we think, that's a tragedy. Why do children die so young and haven't had a chance yet? When you realize that, you know, they come back again, they have another chance. Now, why is it that, you know, you get attracted to this partner and not other partners? Now, the love at first sight is an obvious example. You know, I've known this person before. And there's a couple, I'm not sure if any of you were at one of these retreats. They came to me. They were a couple on one of my retreats in Jhana Grove. You know, we're supposed to be keeping these, you know, the eight precepts and just men and women segregated. It was just almost impossible for these two to keep apart. And they apologized. They told me why. They were, I think, from Europe somewhere. And this girl went up to this guy and he said, your name is David something and I'm going to marry you. I hadn't seen this guy ever before. And he hadn't seen her. She just, you know, totally knew, just this amazing experience. He said, you're my husband. And of course, you know, if someone did that to you, you'd get freaked out and you'd run away. But, you know, he was just totally attracted to her and just couldn't resist it. And so this was, you know, one of the most amazing. And I told him, you know his name? Yeah, I don't know how I knew it, but I knew his name. And it was Dwight. Never met him before. So, you know, that was an incredible love at first sight story. And, you know, that's why, you know, because of those experiences, they're really interested in meditation and past lives. It was just so difficult to keep them apart in the meditation retreat. Oh, but you know, sometimes cause and effect. I know that my limitations too. Anyway, the arising and passing away. Sorry? Okay. You want a question? You got a question? Sorry, yeah.
Ajahn, in the Satipatthana, he mentioned that he contemplate body in body, feeling in feeling. I don't understand why is it not body and instead of it is body in body.
Okay, that is an idiom. It does not mean body in body. He does body contemplation of body. The body contemplation is like a verb. And they use that in so many different other ways. They do path sweeping of paths. They do wall painting of walls. They do dishwashing of dishes. Yeah, we have that, you know, a dishwasher. So you put dishes in a dishwasher. What else would you put in a dishwasher? But it's just the idiom. You do body mindfulness of the body. So when you translate word for word, that's where you get all these strange ideas. This is, again, great advice from Professor A.K. Warder. Never translate word for word. Translate phrase by phrase. And the obvious example, as I was saying earlier, it was raining cats and dogs. That's translating word for word. It does not. Pets don't fall from the sky during a monsoon season. It's just a way of saying it was raining heavily. So we have all these. They were fighting tooth and nail. What it means was a really, you know, really hard fight. So that is another way of writing in Pali, which comes up so often. You read it in Pali again and again, you see the same way of having the Pali language, repetition, and also if you do Dharma speaking of Dharma. In English, we just say Dharma speaking, or we speak the Dharma. No, we just wash dishes. We don't dishwash dishes. But that's the idiom. So it doesn't mean anything other than mindfulness of the body.
Ajahn,
yeah.
The next question is that when for the experience and the citta, how do we contemplate others' experience and others' citta?
Others, this is where you look at another person, you look at yours, you see you have the same tears, we laugh together, we cry together, we're afraid of the same things. You can actually just use the evidence of your senses, inference, to notice that you're not alone in this world, that other people are pretty much the same as you. You get pains in your knees, other people get pains in the knees. You get old, other people get old. You die, other people die. There's still some people say, I am unique. I'm going to be the first person in this world who never dies. You've got to be the first somewhere, so that's going to be me. That's totally different. We always think that we're special, rather than say, as me, as them. It's called sometimes empathy. Walking in a mile in another's shoes. Sometimes that's an important thing to do. If you have any problem with your boss, you know, at work, you should walk a mile in his shoes. And by that time, you'll be so far away, there's no problem anymore. You'll be looking for his shoes. Okay, shall we go on to the next part? Arising and passing away, the rise and fall. Now this, I did say something about this earlier, what it means by rising and passing away, the rise and fall. It doesn't mean just seeing the body, you know, just come up and then lay down, or just things coming and going. It's understanding why they come, why they go. This is from the Satipatthana Samyutta. I will teach you the origination, the samudaya, what many people call rise, and the passing away, atagamana, what people call fall, of the four focuses of mindfulness. Supported by the four nutriments, there is the origination and continuance of the body. With the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. The four nutriments are the food, the six sense contacts, will and consciousnesses. This is the first time you actually see here, don't mention consciousnesses, six different types of consciousness. Consciousnesses. All totally different. Now if you get that understood, then you understand there's no consciousness which is always there all the time. Consciousness comes and consciousness goes. There's six different types. When one is there, the other five are absent. So just by changing the word from consciousness to consciousnesses, sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, body consciousness and mind consciousness, by changing it to consciousnesses, which is really according to how the Buddha taught, it changes much of the way we look at this experience of being a human being. So come across that later maybe, but this is consciousnesses. So that is what is necessary for the origination and continuous of this body. Or when these go, then the body goes. It can't be sustained. Supported by the six sense contacts, there's the origination of experience. With the cessation of six sense contacts, experience ceases. Supported by nama-rupa, the objects of consciousness, there is the origination of the citta, the mind. With the cessation of the nama-rupa, the citta ceases. It's not always there. When the objects of the mind stop, then the citta ceases. It's like when you turn on the TV, then the TV disappears. It's weird, but that's the nature of our body and mind. And supported by attention, there is the origination of mind objects. The cessation of attention and mind objects cease. This is important because there's the old simile of the oil lamp. If you have an oil lamp, or these days a candle, when? Okay. Very good, what are you up to now? When you have a candle, the candle flame depends upon three causes: the wax, the wick, and the heat. When one of those three causes, three nutriments, disappears, such as the wax is all used up, or the wick is all burnt through, or someone blows the flame away, the heat away, then what happens to the flame? It ceases. It's only a result of these three causes. And in the Akawachagota Sutta, the Buddha asked Wachagota, when the flame goes out, where does it go to? He said, does it go east, west, north, south, up or down? He said, it doesn't apply. I just make it a bit more interesting. Does the flame go to heaven if it's been a good flame? Or does it go to hell because it's burnt people? You know, does it? Where does the flame go once its three causes are taken away? It doesn't go anywhere. It was just a phenomena which arose because of three causes. When the three causes stop, so does the flame. You know the word for a flame going out? It nibbanas. That was the word in common usage. Every kid in India at that time would understand the word nibbana. Used it every day. Mom, you know, the flame is nibbanaed. And that's the word which the Buddha used. Anyway, mindfulness of experience. How are you mindful of experience? Vedana. Now, again, many people say, oh no, Vedana means, you know, the quality of happiness, suffering, or in between. And I argue that, no, the Vedati means like to experience something. So we're not just looking at the three different types of experience. Experience in itself. Because this is where, you know, to be is to experience things. Have you got your bucket list of things you want to do before you die? Things you want to experience? Have you seen the Great Wall of China yet? You don't need to. There's a wall outside. Niagara Falls. Just stand in the shower. Same, it's only just different size. So all these things you want to experience. Why? It's just, you know, you've bought into the advertising of the tourist industry. This experience, that's all. When feeling a pleasant experience, you are mindful you feel a pleasant experience. Feeling an unpleasant experience, you are mindful you feel an unpleasant experience. When you feel a neutral experience, you're neutral experience. When feeling a worldly pleasant experience, a worldly unpleasant experience or a worldly neutral experience, and mindful you feel such a worldly pleasant, unpleasant or neutral experience. You know, the worldly, they make a difference here between worldly and unworldly. Amisa, near amisa. When feeling an unworldly pleasant experience, an unworldly unpleasant experience, or an unworldly neutral experience, you are mindful that you feel such an unworldly, unpleasant, or neutral experience. Now, what's the difference between the worldly experience and the unworldly experiences? Because some are to be encouraged and cultivated, some are to be let go of. So some of the worldly experiences are just what's a worldly experience, like watching the latest Star Wars movie. Some of my friends, as a youth group, they've seen the latest Star Wars movie. I forget what it's called. But anyway, they say, oh, it's rubbish. But nevertheless, I still remember this one monk. I think he's a monk now, but he wanted to put off his ordination because he wanted to see the last episode of Harry Potter before he renounced. This is crazy, isn't it? Attachment to things. But it's an unpleasant, that's worldly pleasant experience or worldly unpleasant. What is unworldly pleasant experience? That's jhana, is obviously unworldly, but anything which leads you out of suffering, like inspiration is one of them. When you hear a really good Dhamma talk, or you see someone doing this amazing act of charity, or an amazing act of just kindness, that really inspires you with happiness. You know, mudita, karuna, upeka, you know, metta, some of the things which I've seen, the kindness which people do, oh, that's inspirational. That is a form of happiness which you should cultivate, because that leads to more very wholesome actions in our world. And of course, the jhanas, incredibly blissful. Now, those are very unworldly pleasant experiences. Unworldly, painful experiences. And sometimes when you realize just how much these attachments, you know, are causing me suffering, and you let go of them, it's hard to do sometimes, but it's worth it. Just like taking a tooth out. Yeah, it hurts at the time, but in the long term, it means less suffering. It's hard to renounce sometimes. It is painful if you're a mother or father to give permission for your son or daughter to become a monk or a nun. As I used to tell the chief, Dr. K.C. Dhammananda, I say, in Malaysia, people are just so happy when a young man becomes a monk, as long as it's not their son. Yeah, but it's worth it. It's a bit of unworldly suffering for it's unworldly suffering for it's worth it because the good things come out of it. And the unworldly neutral experience is obviously there's this beautiful peace and stillness. So those understanding, experience, you know, what the good ones are, what the ones to be cultivated and what the ones to be let go of. But in this way, you're aware of your own experience and others' experiences, all the same nature as yours. You abide mindful of both your own and others' experiences. Or you abide aware of what causes the arising of experiences, sensory contact. And you abide aware that experiences of the nature to cease when sensory contact ceases. Or you abide contemplating experiences cause of nature, both arising and ceasing. Or mindfulness, just experience, that's all, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. You can't control experience. It's not under your power, not me, not mine. It'd be wonderful if you could control your experience and only have happiness and never any unhappiness. Because somebody asked me just well, where was this? Recently, somewhere. They asked me about, Ajahn Brahm, do you believe in the Pure Land? So what do you mean, the Pure Land? This is the Pure Land. Have a look at what it says the Pure Land is. The Pure Land is whatever you want to eat, you can get it almost straight away. It's called takeaway. And here in KL, you get any type of food. You get Western food, you get Chinese food, Indian food, vegetarian food, vegan food, anything is here. This is like the Pure Land. Whatever you want to eat, it's there. Music, any type of music you want to hear, get out your iPhone. Any type of entertainment, get out, was it Netflix? And it's there for you straight away, like the Pure Land. Anything you want to buy, just get it on Amazon. Anything, any dhamma you want to hear, look, just get on internet. It's straight there, Sutta Central, whatever else is there, and you get all these amazing teachings straight away. So well done. You've arrived at the Pure Land. So you don't need to put off your enlightenment anymore. You're here. So enjoy. And become enlightened. Anyway, just experience, that's all. To the extent necessary for mindfulness of wisdom is central to liberation, and you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a meditator abides mindful of experience. Just experience, that's all. Just like you could be not afraid of pain. It just comes and it goes. Mindfulness of the citta, of the mind. How are you mindful of the mind? You understand Pachanatipanya. You understand a mind that is affected by wanting as such and a mind that is unaffected by wanting as such. Instead of calling it craving, because craving is just too intense a type of wanting. It's just ordinary wanting. Wanting something. Do you want anything? Do you understand that? It's a mind affected by wanting. What's it like when you don't want anything? You're perfectly content, just happy to be here in this moment. How does that feel? You understand the two different types of mind. You understand a mind that's affected by aversion as such. And a mind that's unaffected by aversion as such. What is it like to be free of ill will? To be totally at peace with things. Not averse to anything in this moment, in this world. What does it feel like? What does it feel like when you averse? I don't want this. You understand a mind that is affected by illusion as such, a mind that is unaffected by delusion as such. You understand a contracted mind as contracted because of dullness and drowsiness. It's a wonderful little metaphor. What does dullness do? It means your mind gets so contracted. So it's in a box, a very narrow box when you're dull. It's got no sort of, no breadth, no understanding. It's no ability to go and see the bigger picture when you're half asleep. When you're dull. Do you understand a distracted mind is distracted because of restlessness and remorse? You can't actually stay with anything. All over the place. You understand an exalted mind, a surpassed mind, a still mind, and a liberated mind. They're all different words referring to the jhana. An unexalted, unsurpassed, not still, and not liberated mind is not in jhana. In this way, you're aware of your own jitta, your own mind. Are you aware that others' jittas are the same as yours? Or you're abide aware of both your own and others' jittas? Or else you're aware of what causes the arising of the jitta, which is something for the jitta to be aware of, the nama rupa, the objects of consciousness. Or you abide aware the jitta is of the nature to cease. It just stops, disappears. When the objects of consciousness disappear. Or you abide contemplating the jitta's causal nature, both arising and ceasing. Or else mindful is just a mind, that's all, just a chitta. Impermanent. Suffering. Having a jitta is suffering. Because it always messes around. not me, not mind, not a permanent essence. The citta is not a permanent essence. It's established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential to liberation. So it's nothing to do with you, this consciousness, the mind consciousness or any other consciousnesses. It just comes and goes, causes and effects, that's all. So you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how you are mindful of the mind. Any question about that? Sometimes it's hard to know what a person means by the mind. Remember, each one of those, these satipatthanas, is done having restrained the five hindrances, first of all. You've got to restrain them a long way to be able to know what the mind is. This is an adaptation of a Buddhist simile. This, he used the simile of a goldsmith. How to purify the gold first of all before you can actually work with it. My simile was of the emperor. There was this very powerful emperor. But the only time the emperor came out into public was when the emperor was wearing five pieces of clothing which covered the body completely. Now, I've been very careful. I never said his body or her body or it body because no one knew the gender of this emperor. They didn't even know the race, the age, or anything about the emperor, because whenever the emperor appeared, was covered in these five pieces of clothing, boots which came up to the thighs, trousers which overlapped the top of the boots and came way up, you know, past his belly button, his navel, the navel, and then a jacket which went way over the top of the trousers, with long sleeves to the wrists and with high collar halfway up the neck. On the end of the hands were these big gloves which overlapped the edge of the jacket, and a helmet which overlapped the top of the jacket. So there were five pieces of clothing, the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet meant you could not see any part of the emperor's body at all. So no one knew what the emperor really was, except it was really powerful. So the only way you can find out what the emperor is to take off all the clothes and find out what is this emperor underneath. And in this simile, the five pieces of clothing represent the five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Which cover the thing that we call the mind so completely, we don't really know what this mind is. So we take away the five pieces of clothing. And then you see the sixth sense, the mind, the citta, all by itself. Then you understand what it is. You have to let go of the five senses. You know what that's called? Jhana. Because in the jhana you can't hear anything. You can't see anything. You can't smell, taste or feel any senses through the body. Those five things disappear. Only temporary, they come back in afterwards. And that's the way you can tell if a person's in the jhana. Speak to them. Hey, time to go now. And they can't hear. Touch them. And they won't feel anything. So this is where the five senses stop for a while, allowing you to be with the citta, the mind, for enough time to understand what this emperor truly is. That is why we do these deep meditations. That, as far as I'm concerned, is the only way you can really complete that third satipatthana. Da, da, da. Any questions? Yes.
I Ajahn, the meaning that this third satipatthana is done in the jhana, it's not in our daily life?
No. While you're in the jhana, you cannot contemplate. You are too still. But that is what gives you the data to contemplate afterwards. As a scientist, a trained scientist, you never contemplate the results of the experiment when they're coming in. You collect all the data without any preference until when all the data from your experiment is in, then you try and work out what it means. So the job of the jhanas is giving you the data of what it's like when the five senses stop and all you have left is a jitta. And when you emerge from those jhanas, when the mind and the other five senses start coming back online, when you can think, then you contemplate it. Just like my favorite simile of the tadpole and the frog. Once upon a time there was a little tadpole which lived in a lake next to the BTF. Have you got any lakes around here? Okay, well, in Bickfield's temple. There's a lake over there. So this little tadpole lived in a pond next to Bickfield's temple. And she was a very, very clever tadpole. She went to tadpole school. And she graduated from school and studied chemistry in the little university. And she even listened to some of the Abhidhamma talks, you know, which was on the nature of the elements, especially water. She became such an expert on water. That's what she focused on. She got a PhD in water. But do you think a tadpole could really understand the nature of water? Even though she had studied it, learned the Abhidhamma on water, and also got a PhD in water? That tadpole can't understand water, no matter how many books it reads, how many lessons it learns, because the tadpole has spent all its life in water. Can't understand the nature of water no more than a fish can understand the nature of water. But the difference between a fish and a tadpole is that one day a little tadpole, she grows legs and arms. Weird, but all these appendages coming out of its body. She is transforming into a frog. And one day the little frog, not really knowing what it's doing, lets go enough and jumps out of the lake or the pond. And that's weird. That's one of the strangest experiences a tadpole had ever had. Because this is totally different than anything it's known before. Something which has always been there, which it couldn't recognize before, is missing. Water. Now, tadpole, now a frog, could understand what water is once it's disappeared. That's like the jhanas. Something which has always been there, which has always been there, so you haven't noticed it, is missing. The five senses, the body, and more things later on start disappearing. That's the only way you can really understand it. That's where you get the data from. Otherwise, you can't really fully understand what's underneath these five senses. The emperor always appeared with the senses around it. The jitta, alone, naked, without anything to hinder you seeing its true nature. Come and go. Okay, it's almost 4 o'clock. Do you want to continue on? Or yes, this is overtime. Penalty rates in Australia. Okay, here we go. We go through this reasonably quickly. The mindfulness of mind. If you need to go, please, you know, I don't get embarrassed. If you want to go to the toilet, the letting go, please do so out of kindness to yourself. It's all being recorded, so if you miss something, you can look at it later on. How are you mindful of mind objects? You are mindful of mind objects in terms of, first of all, the five hindrances. Hey, I thought you're supposed to restrain the five hindrances before you even start any of these satipatthanas. How can you be mindful of the things which stop you being mindful? When there was wanting regarding the five senses, you are mindful there was such wanting. When there is no wanting, you are mindful there is no such wanting. You also understand how such wanting arises, how to let go of such wanting, and how such wanting doesn't arise again. Not in the present moment, this is the understanding part. There being aversion in you, there being dullness and drowsiness in you, there being restlessness and remorse in you. When there was doubt in you, you are mindful there was such doubt. When there is no such doubt, you are mindful there is no doubt. You also understand how such doubt arises, how to let go of doubt, and how doubt doesn't arise again. You understand the five hindrances, what causes them, how they're overcome. Because the five hindrances, they are what stops you becoming still, stops you becoming free. They are the ones which weaken wisdom. They are enemy five. Suppose you took out a loan and your business was successful. Then you repaid that loan and there was enough left over for your enjoyment and that of your family. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. And that's what wanting is. Wanting is getting into debt. But when you give up all your wanting, you're free. Then you're happy. Well, suppose you're very ill, you couldn't eat or sleep and had no strength. Later, however, you recovered, could eat and sleep again, and you regained your strength. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. That's ill will, aversion. It's an illness. And you can't do anything until you get rid of that stupid person who made your life a misery. So that's what anger is, an aversion. Or suppose you were imprisoned and later were released, safe and secure, with no loss to your property. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. That's why being dull, drowsiness, like you're in a prison, you can't do anything or go anywhere. Or suppose you were a slave, dependent on others, unable to go where you want. Then later you were released from slavery, independent of others, able to go where you want. As a result, you'd be glad and full of joy. That's restlessness and remorse. Controlling you. Always telling you, get up, go down, don't stay here, go somewhere else. That restlessness is like being a slave. Can't sit still, always being pushed to be on the move. Or suppose you had to travel along a dangerous road across a wilderness. But later you would pass through that wilderness, safe and secure, with no loss to your property. As a result, you'd be glad and full of joy. That is the doubt. Not really knowing what to do, where to go. So too, when these five hindrances were present, you looked down upon them as a debt. That's wanting something. It's a debt because until you get what you want, or you give up that wanting, you're in debt to the wanting. A disease, it's aversion, a prison, dullness and drowsiness, slavery, restlessness and remorse, and a dangerous road across a wilderness, doubt. Well, these five hindrances, when these five hindrances have been abandoned, you regard that as freedom from debt, health, release from prison, freedom from slavery, and reaching a land of safety. And a similarly, you know, which for that fifth hindrance, which I have found very useful, was an anecdote from when I was a student. I liked solitude, so I'd go up into the mountains in Scotland. You know, with the tent, I'd stay 5 or 6 days up there. And one day, I was just resting in a hostel, a youth hostel. Beautiful morning, summertime in Scotland, far, far north. And the warden of the hostel, just a local fellow, invited me to go and walk up one of the mountains. Not a tall mountain. Took a 2 or 3 hours. When we got to the top of the mountain, stood a beautiful day, and I sat down, enjoyed the view, and there's another mountain. I said, let's go up that one too. He said, no, I'll go back, you just go up by yourself, which is a silly thing to do.
because mountains, wildernesses are dangerous. And I just couldn't believe just how dangerous they are, because when I almost got to the top of the next mountain, the clouds had come in from the ocean, and they descended over the mountain. It was just like no time at all. 5 minutes was a clear sky. The next, I was enveloped in the mist of the cloud. And I couldn't see just, you know, the end of my arm. It was dangerous. But at that time I thought I had a sense of direction. So I just decided to retrace my steps. Just know how much we have not got a sense of direction at all. Because eventually I found out that I'd gone in 180 degrees opposite to the direction I thought I was going in. Because I checked it up on the map afterwards. Because I came one step to this huge cliff. One more step and I wouldn't be here. It was that, no, not exaggeration, it was that close. And I, there's only one cliff like that on that mountain, and it was totally the opposite direction I was thought I was going in. And that scared me. Because, you know, you're in a mist. You don't know where you're going. And sometimes you go round and round in circles, never getting out. And those mists could last for weeks. I was in trouble. So instead of worrying about fear, just, you know, calm down, use a bit of common sense. And what I did was just basic science, find a little creek, because water always goes downhill. And I followed the creek, whichever way it wound, I'd follow it. Went this way, that way, and I kept on following it. Another little creek came into it, made a bigger stream, kept on following it, because I knew it'd always be going downhill. And I went down, 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 until I was underneath the cloud cover. And then I could get my directions and find it back, way back to the hostel. You know, many hours late, very tired, but that's how I escaped from the mist. And I thought, what a wonderful simile that is of overcoming doubt. Many monks will sit up here, nuns, and they teach you all sorts of different things. Which way should we follow? Whatever leads to more peace, more kindness, less argument, a sense of being more content, less wanting. Those are those indicators you're going in the correct direction. Like the water is going downhill. I'm going closer, closer, closer to finding my way. So that is actually how you overcome doubt. You feel, you know, this is peaceful, this is kind, this is, you know, you're becoming more wise. That means it's in the right direction. It's creating more arguments with your friends. You're getting more anger, you're wanting more stuff. That must mean that you're going in the wrong direction. And you get to that point in this simile, when you're underneath the cloud cover, then you can see all the directions. That's called stream winning. You can see everything. Now you know the way to safety. That's where you overcome doubt. Under the mists. So it's a wonderful little simile, and that's how you can find your way home. That's five hindrances, the fifth hindrances of doubt. And we finish off with the seven enlightenment factors, because in the earliest version of Satipatthana, this is where it stops. There's many versions of Satipatthana in ancient texts. The earliest ones are simple for the Dhamma objects. It's the five hindrances and seven enlightenment factors. That's it. Or you are mindful of mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you, you understand that it is present. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness was not present, you understand it was not or was absent. You also understand the cause, how there comes to be the arising of the absent enlightenment factor of mindfulness, and how it comes to fulfillment by development, how to generate it. When the enlightenment factor of exploring the Dhamma is present in you, remember what I said, exploring the Dhamma? You have a look at it, keep your attention on it until you see things you haven't seen before. Breaking through to insight. When the enlightenment factor of joy is present in you, you know that when you sort of see some new Dhamma, you get really peaceful. It's a really joyful experience. You feel uplifted. Joy is part of the path.
where the environment factor of tranquility is present in you, stillness is present in you, that's samadhi. I didn't say the energy, so the energy is present in you. Joy, tranquility, stillness, equanimity is present in you. You understand that it is present, but when these enlightenment factors of equanimity, all the other ones, are not present in you, you understand that it was absent. And you also understand how there comes to be the arising of the absent enlightenment factor of equanimity and how it comes to fulfillment by development. Because these are opposites. The five hindrances are the opposite of the enlightenment factors. So by restraining, eventually abandoning the five hindrances, the enlightenment factors come into force. And when they're developed, they lead to nibbana. So that's why we call the five hindrances enemy number one. So when they are calmed down through wisdom, not through force, through understanding, then the enlightenment factors develop. And that becomes the fourth satipatthana. The other ones, the khandhas, I call them components of existence. Now the factors which make up this thing we call existence, the six sense bases, the four noble truths, and in this way you are aware of some of the mind objects. You're aware of mind objects, others' mind objects, the same in nature as yours. You're both aware of both your own and others' mind objects. You understand what causes the arising of these mind objects, what they cease, they're causing and ceasing. Or else mindfulness is just mind objects, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential liberation. You abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. So the summary of the Satipatthana, so it was with reference to this that it was said the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, the realization of nibbana. Now that is the rest of what you have on here is just from the Anapanasati Sutta, how doing mindfulness of breathing leads to completing, fulfilling all of the four satipatthanas. So the first four, you know, watching your in-breath, in, now I'm just going through this really quickly because I'm over time, is watching the in-breath, long, short, the whole breath, and just calming that body foundation. That's aware of the body. That fulfills, the Buddha says, the first satipatthana. Because the Buddha says, on these occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindful in and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body, in a category of bodies. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the body, just doing the first four factors of Anapanasati. Or when you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, pleasure, the sukha, the whole mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and out, when you calm this mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and out, on that occasion you are mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of experience. It's an experience, Vedana, the joy, the piti sukha, the happiness, in the, what I call that, the beautiful breath. You're aware of Vedana there, not the breath, but the Vedana, that aspect of the breath which is joyful and pleasant. And you're supposed to do that. It's the next four factors of the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth factor of Anapanasati. You're supposed to have fun and enjoy yourself. This is Niramisa Sukha, the unworldly happiness. And if anybody says, ooh, if you enjoy meditation, you're going to get attached, yes, go for it. Because the Buddha said, it's not here, but I can show it to you afterwards, that anyone who gets attached to the pleasures of meditation, if you get attached to it, indulge in the pleasures of meditation, you can only expect four consequences. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's the Pasada Sutta. That's what you're supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be a happy path. And this is the second of the Satipatthanas with the Anapanasati. You fulfill the Vedana Satipatthana. when you learn to experience the citta as you breathe in and out, this is this beautiful light which comes up in the mind, the nimitta. That is just how a person experiences the nimitta. This mind is radiant, prabhasara, when those five hindrances are suppressed. The radiant mind, it's beautiful light in the mind, nimitta. When you learn how to brighten the nimitta up, settle the nimitta, okay, still, or when you learn how to enter jhana, that's liberating the mind. Liberating the mind is, if you know your Pali, it's a code word, the eight liberations of the mind, those are jhanas. Then you are, on those occasions, you're mindful of the citta. That's how you do the citta satipatthana. With the 9th, 10th, 11th and 12th of the satipatthana. And when you learn how to explore impermanence, fading away, ceasing, relinquishing things in breath meditation, on those occasions you are mindful of the mind objects, the Dhamma, the 4th satipatthana. So those are actually when you do the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th steps of Anapanasati, you are fulfilling the 4th satipatthana. This is what the Buddha said, there's no difference between Anapanasati and Satipatthana. Then the four focuses of mindfulness complete the seven enlightenment factors. The seven enlightenment factors make you enlightened. Easy, simple. So there we go. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, please. Mind and mind objects. What's the difference between the TV and the programs on the TV? One is a screen on which these things play out. Without the screen, you can't have the objects. Without the objects, the screen vanishes. They have the nama rupa and the citta. They have the Buddha simile of two sheaves of rice stalks. You know, I don't know if you've seen people, they thresh the rice, you know, from the stalks, and then they dry the stalks out, you know, maybe for using 4 feet for the animals later on in the year. And to dry them out, they lean one against the other. If you take one of them away, the other one will fall down. So this is the simile of the Buddha, the two sheaves of reeds supporting one another. Without the citta, there's no mind objects. Without the mind objects, there's no citta. They disappear. And that is straight down the line, quantum physics, Schrodinger equation, the Copenhagen interpretation. To have an event, you have to have an observer. If there's no observer, there's no event. If a tree falls in a forest and no one observes it, it hasn't fallen. And it's not straight up either. The probability is there. It's a probability. But it's not happened. Schrodinger's cat. It's not a Buddhist, very Buddhist simile, but it's really weird. There's Erwin Schrodinger, one of the founders of quantum physics. He said, imagine you put a cat in a closed box, and it's a cyanide capsule there, and it was attached to a quantum process like the decay of a cesium atom. And after about half an hour, there's a 50-50 chance, because it's a quantum process, of the cesium atom decaying and the cyanide capsule breaking and killing the cat. So if after that half an hour, is the cat alive or dead? And the answer was, it's not alive. The answer is, it's not dead. It's in the quantum state. Neither alive nor dead until you open the box. I don't know what the cat thinks about that. But that's what quantum science says. It's not the one, not the other. It's a third option. And I love that, because that bend. And that's so true. We have quantum computers now. That's what they rely on. And they work. So, without the mind, without an observation, there's nothing to observe. The other part ceases. Without something to observe, the mind stops, ceases. I love doing a bit of stuff like this. Any other?
Ajahn?
Yeah, where are you?
The okay. Seventh enlightenment factors. Number three, when you say that when the enlightenment factors of energy, is the energy meant effort?
No, effort destroys energy. It tires you out. This is one thing which, you know, I teach a lot about mindfulness. Everyone is mindful. Even a drunken person is mindful. They find their way home sooner or later. But the level of mindfulness is very, very low. But what happens is through stillness, through just relaxing, not doing very much, you'll find because the brain is not working so hard, it starts to recharge. Just like you recharge your mobile phones. And when it gets really recharged, it gets really powerful. So through stillness, your mindfulness increases in power. And people experience that on retreat, when they come out of a deep meditation and the leaves look more green than they've ever seen before. And they have a drink of water, and the water is so incredibly sweet. You are picking up so much more of what's out there because your mindfulness is more aware, more powerful. This is where I usually say that lovely poem by William Blake, 16th, 17th century English poet and also artist, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, which are tiny, see, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. That sort of describes what it's like to have really strong mindfulness. You see, just in a computer, the plastic on the outside is incredibly beautiful. Just not black, it's just all different types of black and shimmering. You're not going crazy, you're just getting powerful mindfulness. You're seeing much deeper into things. And people have those experiences. At a time when you're just so content, so energized, you take a cup of tea and it's a taste explosion. Wow. I remember, just because somebody made me some baked beans this morning, I had a lovely retreat, I forget when, and the first food I had, you know, in the breakfast in the morning was a spoon of baked beans, and wow. I've never ever tasted baked beans like that before in my life. It was incredible, the power of the tomato and the texture of the beans and the little bit of salt in there. It was just wow. It was just out of a can. Nothing to do with the cook, nothing to do with the product. My mind was just so powerful. That, you know, one baked beans, wow, that was incredible. So that's what happens. That's where you get the energy from stillness. You've recharged your mind. So that's great when people do that. They go on these retreats and they're just blissing out. It's amazing. You can see them just watching just a little flower on a bush. Wow, it's amazing. Good fun. So, yeah, any other questions before we finish? Yes.
Can you elaborate on equanimity? Yeah. The understanding of equanimity.
Equanimity literally means upekkha, means just looking on. Being aware without interfering. Without wanting, without not wanting. Just seeing, hearing, knowing, just without interfering, without wanting, without pushing away, letting it be. Hard thing to do, because usually we just get involved with stuff. You know what it's like? I'll give you an exercise now to make it quite clear. Can you now be aware of the saliva in your throat? Can you pay attention to that? Now just let it be. Now you can't. Now you're watching it. It's a problem. Because as soon as our nature is, as soon as we observe something, we want to control it. It's nature. Beforehand, your saliva was no problem at all. Now you're aware of it. It is. Have you noticed that's with your breathing as well? When you ask yourself to watch your breath, it's uncomfortable. You interfere with it whenever you're aware of it. That's why just mindfulness first. Just relax. Let the breath come to you, and then it's nice and peaceful. Upeka is a very difficult thing to do. Yes. Can I explain what? Yeah. What is Nibbana? Very easy. This is a nice place to finish for today because you can't go beyond Nibbana. And this is the great simile of the children playing the wishing game. So there are five children and they were playing the wishing game. The rules were this. Every child had a wish. And the one who came up with the best wish would win the game. So the first kid, I mean 19 years of age, said, I want a new Nintendo game. Because I like playing computer games. And the second kid had more time to think. So he said, I could do better than that. I wish I had a computer game store. If I own the shop, I can get not just the latest Nintendo, but the next game whenever it comes out. I own the shop. So that was obviously the superior wish. And the third kid said, no, 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 if I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion US. Because with $100 billion US, I can buy my own computer game shop, because I like computer games as well. But the trouble is, my mother won't let me play computer games until I finish my homework. So the next thing I'll buy is my own school. And if I own the school and employ the teachers, then if they give me any homework, I'll sack them. And when I graduate from my own school, and I'll buy my own university and give myself a PhD, you know, because I own the place. Honorary, of course. And that way I won't have to go to school anymore. I can just spend all the time playing computer games. And whatever else I want, whenever I want it, with $100 billion US, you know, you can get whatever you want for the rest of your life. So beat that. Now, don't think the next child said 110 or 200 billion US, because 100 billion US is like as much money as you could spend. So, the next kid, really smart, said, well, if I had a wish, this is kid number four, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. And for my first wish, I'd have the computer game shop. My second wish, I'll have $100 billion US. And for my third wish, I'd have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. That's really smart. Beat that. And the fourth kid said, well, if I had a wish, I would wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. So content I don't need wishes anymore. That was the Buddha describing enlightenment. The end of craving, the end of wanting. I don't need any more wishes. Number four, having all your wishes, that's like someone who becomes President of the United States. Just wanting power to get whatever you want whenever you want it. The third wish, being so rich, you know, that was like a Bill Gates. Why does Bill Gates have to keep on working? Can't he just retire? But we always want more. And you've never noticed, the people who are really millionaires, billionaires, they go into politics. Crazy, isn't it? Because, yeah, they have money, but they don't have power. So kid number three, you know, is wanting as much money as you could ever spend, wealth. Kid number four wanted power. All his wishes granted. Kid number five realized that wealth and power was never going to give you any happiness. Contentment, being so content I don't need any more wishes ever again.
That's called Nibbana. The end of craving. And the end of this talk as well. Okay, see, sadhus. Sadhu. 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 Okay. So there's another session at, is it 7 or 8 o'clock? 7. So just...